Here's a number that stopped me in my tracks. 54% of Americans feel stressed about money multiple times a week. Today's guest, Lev Mendel, has spent his career trying to understand why, and more importantly, what to do about it. Lev is a financial advisor, accredited investment fiduciary, London School of Economics graduate, and author of the workbook Money is Weird, which approaches financial anxiety not with more advice or more data, but with a guided reflection, compassionate curiosity, and the radical premise that understanding yourself is the most powerful financial move you can make. We're thrilled to have him on the show today. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Kevin. It's really a pleasure.
What drove you to becoming a financial advisor?
You know, I think that depends on how far back we want to go. But let's start with, and we'll get into more as we talk about the workbook. But I think, you know, the moment I realized I wanted to be a financial advisor, I was teaching Algebra 2, which is not the most fun math. And, the principal comes in and says, I got this great idea. We're going to do electives. And you get to pick an elective with your subject, you know. And so my first thought is, oh, great. You know, no kids are going to sign up for the math elective. What's this going to be? Turned out it changed my life. I ended up teaching a class on investing. We did, I'd structured it. So we did a mini lesson for about 15 minutes on an investment concept. And then we got the Chromebooks, the school Chromebooks, and the kids, you know, invested 100,000 of imaginary money and were super active. And I think, you know, my absolute favorite thing about being a math teacher is when that light bulb just goes off. With the investing course, I really saw a change there of how much more interested and how much more fun the students were having with it.
And just barely mentioned on why you codified writing this book, mainly for your financial advising clients. When did that click?
Yeah, so I think it took me time to kind of find my path with advising. And I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, really started to be clear to me was that as much as we were doing, you know, and I could nerd out on the traditional financial planning, there was a lot more underneath kind of what these numbers were saying. And so I really wanted to start to explore that. And then interestingly, I had known about Carissa Potter, you know, as an artist in San Francisco in kind of 2012, 2015, you saw her stuff and it was really awesome. I think, you know, because of the really the emotional honesty of it. And so I had seen her work, but I happened to be in a small beach coastal town in Marin County, California. And I walked into a cute little store and they had this gratitude journal. And I picked it up and said, wow, this is really awesome because I'm not a good journaler. Even though I wrote a journal, I'm not a good journaler. And what I loved about this journal was it was you just write one thing each day that you are thankful for. And I thought to myself, okay, I can do that. I can't journal. I like writing, but I'm not a journaler, but I can write one thing a day that I'm thankful for. And, you know, I was using this journal and I thought, hey, this would be a great thing for clients. And I'd love to do a run of these for clients. And it's so easy to get caught up in kind of the stress and the anxiety around money. Let's also look at how can we be thankful for what we have and what we're able to do. And this is a really cute, fun way to do it. So I pitched Carissa on doing a run of journals for my clients. And we did a little gratitude journal to start it out. And then, you know, she came and dropped off those journals. And I kind of, right before she came, I kind of sketched out some ideas I had about a financial anxiety journal. And she was into it. And the rest was history there. And you know, I think as much as she's an artist and an illustrator, she really is an author too. So she was such a fantastic partner in this in terms of kind of, you know, really the emotional honesty. Her style really fits with kind of imperfection as a feature as opposed to a bug, right? And that I think that's really important in terms of financial planning, that we don't always have to make the right decision, but if we're aware about what the decision we're making, that's a big step. You know, I thought, oh, this will be fun. I'm going to write these questions. And then Chris is like, no, man, you need an outline and you need to do this. And this is a real project. And it was a much bigger project than I originally thought. But, you know, it, I really did notice how much I enjoyed doing it while I was writing.
I guess I need to understand a little bit more. You said that after spending all these years with clients, the clearest lessons you've learned is it's not the spreadsheets that get in the way, it's everything underneath. What are you trying to get at there?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, at the core of it, I think certainly there's the emotional stuff, right? So fear, anxiety, grief, sadness, guilt, hopelessness, all those things. Hope, the positive sides too, you know, the aspirations, goals. And then also, though, I think there's also kind of the more social component that goes into it, also kind of the comparison, the identity component, the self-worth component. And so really, I think that's what I mean by kind of both the feelings, you know, and the social constructs underneath the spreadsheets, really, you know, which are representing, you know, it's easy to use numbers to represent and score, you know, so we use them and our brain likes that.
So the book identifies three patterns that people fall into: retail therapy, comparison, and avoidance. Which of those do you see most often in your clients, and which one do you think causes the most long-term damage?
This is a great question. I would say avoidance is probably the one I see the most. You know, I think one that I left out of the journal or that I didn't pay much attention to is hoarding. So I would add that in, but I would say, you know, the one I see most is avoidance. And then hoarding probably, you know, is the opposite of that, of really being careful, too careful and tight around money. So that, you know, the client who has, you know, more than enough money to do everything they want to do times seven, but doesn't know if they can afford a refrigerator. So no, but I think, you know, so it depends certainly on the generation. And I think that's really interesting too, of when you were born and the lessons you learned about money as a kid, and kind of what those habits are. But I would say, you know, in terms of my clients, the one I see the most is avoidance.
Let's stay on avoidance and explain what it is. Can we stay on avoidance and explain what it is?
Yeah.
You know, never looking at investment statements, not knowing how much is in your checking account, you know, not paying attention at all to, you know, personal cash flow, credit card debt, you know, and it's a habit, right? If we look at it as a habit, it's something that probably we picked up when we were young that are, you know, felt right at the time, hey, I want to avoid this. I don't want to deal with it. I'm going to go do something else and I'm going to let it kind of linger. And then, you know, it feels good while it's lingering and we're doing something else, but then it's still there and we have to go back. So, you know, I think avoidance is probably the one I see the most and also probably the one that does the biggest damage over time, just as far as the work that I'm doing with clients.
You talk about money triggering feelings around safety, identity, and survival. Those are primal, almost biological responses. How do you help someone rewire something that deep?
Totally. Well, I got really interested in looking at behavioral therapy and specifically cognitive behavioral therapy. And one of the books that I really gravitated toward is called Unwinding Anxiety by Judson Brewer, who's an anxiety expert. And he has an approach where you're looking at trigger behavior result. And that's been really helpful for me personally as I look at my own financial anxiety. So what I tried to do in the journal is map that out in terms of looking at financial habits and financial decisions. And so I think what's been really helpful for me is looking at, okay, what triggers me to, let's look at a behavior that I do, right? Like, so let's say, I think one that's really relatable that we can all relate to is tax time. So, you know, every year, you know, I tell myself I'm going to do a better job of getting my stuff together for my tax person. And I, you know, that I look at it and I'm like, oh man, I got other stuff going on with work and personal and I'll do that next week. Then, you know, it's 2 weeks from tax time. I'm scrambling. I'm moving money around. I'm tracking down documents. I'm getting it to them, but I'm feeling anxious, right? I've created these feelings within myself of this anxiety, this stress. I probably spent $25 sending a wire I didn't have to spend if I had just gotten ahead of it. And then You know, the good thing, though, about tax time is there is this date. So then there's this date. It makes me do it. I send the stuff to the tax person. We knock it out. I feel so much better, right? Oh, my taxes are done for this year. If I owe a lot, at least I know how much I owe. It, you know, and there's this thing with taxes, especially if you're a small business owner, of not knowing exactly when you're doing it. I hope I did a good job with my estimated taxes. I don't know what this is going to look like, right? I hope I've got enough saved for both. Yeah, that and next year. So, you know, I think though taxes nice have this deadline. You kind of force you to do it. You do it and you feel better. I think though I never took a second to look at that pattern, to look at those feelings that I was having. And what's been really helpful for me is just to even take a second and sit with that anxiety. When I'm anxious and it's April 9th and I just got the stuff to the tax guy, and just taking a sit, how does this feel? Just being curious about it and just kind of going inside for a second and sitting with that, and it doesn't feel good. And then my brain can start to develop some new habits and getting new data that actually I don't like this anxiety. It doesn't feel good. And I start to kind of build those new pathways of, you know, and I don't need to do it. Next year might not be perfect, but over time, I start to learn and my brain starts to learn that, hey, actually, this isn't a good habit. It's a better habit if we just get ahead of this.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we can all relate to that one.
I just wanted to go back because we mentioned those three patterns and we didn't define, we talked about avoidance. I just want to quickly define the other two, retail therapy and comparison.
You know, I think retail therapy often, at least the image I think a lot of us have is, oh, you're going and you're buying stuff that's, you know, kind of frivolous or, you know, totally discretionary. But I think it's bigger than that. You know, I think the idea is, hey, you know, I've got this habit either that I learned as a kid or this pattern where I get rewarded for doing something good. I get a monetary reward. I get a present. That feels good to me. This is how I'm shown love, right? And so, you know, I think whether or not we're really aware of that, a lot of times, I'll just use a personal example. A lot of times, you know, if I'm working really hard or in the past I've been working really hard at work and I have one of those weeks where I, you know, put in 80, 100 hours and I'm like, I'm going to go, you know, buy myself something cool or I'm going to book a vacation. And I'm doing that to reward myself. But it's not that I'm going buying a pair of, you know, Ferragamo loafers. It's that I'm doing something, I'm using money to reward myself. And that is also, you know, something that I've grown up with, that I've developed a habit that I get happy when I feel rewarded financially.
But that's not necessarily bad, because that's one of the steps in your workbook, not only buying something for yourself, but, you know, getting a gift for someone. I remember seeing that, I think, in the past area.
Absolutely. So I think the key is the awareness, right? So I think it can be really good, right? Because a lot of us too have the opposite reaction where we won't ever buy anything for ourselves, mm-hmm. right? And no matter how hard we work and no matter how much money we have saved up for retirement. So I think the idea really is getting to that awareness point and then making an intentional decision. Yes, I really want this. Yes, this is really important to me, as opposed to just doing it because I worked hard that day. And I think, you know, that's where, even if I'm saying, hey, I'm reacting to this hard week of work and then doing something, as opposed to I want to be really intentional about what I'm spending my money on and planning a trip or something that really is what I want to be doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, what about comparison? How do you define that?
Comparison is just so easy because I think, one, we're human, right? So we're looking at, you know, what other people have. It's so much easier to do nowadays than it was, you know. I mean, I think we have this impression that the 50s was the golden age of, you know, growth and American, you know, economic success. And I think when you look at most measures, and Morgan Housel does a great essay about this, by both measures, you know, we are way more well off now than we were then. But what's so much different is, one, the vast inequality, right? The difference between those who have and those who don't. And then also the proximity. You see all this stuff on Instagram, you know, social media. You're seeing people fly private jets and sit courtside at NBA games. And you know, in the 50s, your boss maybe had, you know, the same house and a slightly better car than you, but you went on the same vacations. The boss made a little bit more, but it wasn't this big difference, right? It wasn't right in front of your face. And so I think it's so easy nowadays to compare. You know, people are posting stuff all day about how great their financial situation is. But I think also just the mechanics of money being represented by numbers. And that is one of the coolest, I think, coolest inventions of all humankind, is that we've got this system, right, that works and is really liquid and clear, and we can use numbers. And at the same time, it makes it so easy to use these numbers to compare ourselves to other people. Within 2 seconds, we can compare my retirement account to your retirement account and have a sense of kind of where we are there. Right. And so I think it's really easy. It's also, you know, I think really we're social beings. So it's easy to see other people and compare yourselves and want what they have and be relative. I think one of the questions I really like thinking about is, you know, would you rather be one of the richest people in the Gilded Age or middle class now? Right. And, you know, if you're one of the middle richest people in the Gilded Age, yes, compared to everyone else, you can do all these things. You've got all these resources, you got all this, but you don't have a refrigerator. You don't have access to healthcare, you know, penicillin. It's probably not great.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, I think this, the comparison started before social media with that TV show, Lifestyles, the Rich and Famous. People had a look into what the ultra wealthy we're doing. So
I agree. And I think certainly a kind of that shift in the 80s, right? Of, hey, you know, this is cool and glamorous and, you know, aspirational. And I'm a kid of the 80s. So I grew up, you know, looking up to all that stuff. And absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. So a lot of what you talk about is sort of behavioral, right? You have an economic background in behavioral finance. Help me understand a little bit about, is there a tension between knowing what the rational choice is on the one hand and actually being able to make it? And how do you deal with that?
Oh, I love that, Roger. Thank you. That is the core tension, right? That's, I think, the core tension of our work. I think, you know, for me, interestingly, you know, I wish behavioral finance as a real kind of academic body was around when I was in school, because one of my first jobs and, you know, gaming revenue from smoke-free policies. But I think what became really much more interesting was a different project around, you know, part of what we were able to look at was a settlement in 1998 where the tobacco industry had to put their documents online and available for us to research and go through. So I was reading a lot of documents from Philip Morris executives, marketing executives, and in a lot of ways, I learned business from Philip Morris marketing executives, or marketing. I never took marketing in class in school. And so, but I think the most interesting thing was there was these documents around marketing cigarettes on college campuses and the amount of resources that was going into that and the internal conversations around, if we can get cigarettes into the habits, the daily habits, the lifestyle habit of these college kids, they will be smokers for life, or they'll be smokers for a long time. And that, I think, is so interesting around kind of how much the marketing world understand habits. And, you know, I think, and how much it is important for us when we're looking at behavioral finance and behavioral psychology that, you know, we're really looking at how our brain works and how it's triggered. And a lot of that, based on efficiency, is based on habits. And if the cigarettes companies knew that they could, you know, kind of get cigarettes into your daily habit, that was going to be really important. And so I think I love that now I'm looking at habits around spending and savings with my clients, and, you know, how important habits really are in our lives.
Yeah, and so this workbook would be perfect for college students just getting started in their financial life, and it could also be something you would revisit. Get another copy of the workbook when you have a major life change, maybe when you get married, when you have your first child, death of a loved one. It's you could definitely go deeper into your own relationship to money. Love it.
Absolutely. And Kevin, what I love about what you said, and you know this too, is I think, you know, something that's really fun in financial planning is when you're looking at, you know, your current situation, your data, and then you look at it a year later, 2 years later, and it looks better, right? And so I think one thing that's fun about this journal, you know, rather than your net worth statement, we're looking at, hey, how did you feel? How satisfied did you feel in these areas of your life now? And here's a snapshot of it. And hopefully, you know, with this work we're doing a year from now, 2 years from now, that looks better. And that, you know, that's a nice way to measure progress.
Exactly. I talked to clients about the same thing. It's like they wonder, should I pay off my mortgage? And I said, can you sleep at night, you know, knowing that you have that mortgage? Yeah, it's how you sleep is so important. Okay, so important. Yeah. So the weirdest thing, you said the weirdest thing about money is that it comes and goes, but time only goes. Yet we treat money as though it matters more than time. Can you say more about that and how it's changed the financial decisions you make in your own life?
You know, this is a big one for me. And I think, you know, I think what's important about the journal is we go back and we really look at the past and how these money stories start at such an early age. And so I'm going to go back, you know, but for me personally, when I look at what I thought the dad male role was when I was a kid, it was that you worked hard, you worked long hours, and you made a lot of money, and that's how you showed love and supported the family. For me, I have seen myself over the course of my career prioritize money. That's what I do. I go make money, right? I go work in finance. I go work in tech. I go and I make money, and that's my role. And I'll show you money by giving you gifts and by spending. But when I'm looking at this, when I'm looking at it and really getting curious about my relationship to money, you know, I think this is something that I really have to be honest about. And so I found myself always prioritizing money. I mean, here's a good example. A couple of years ago, we go away on this really nice vacation that I'm spending a lot of money on. I'm in the house we're renting working. And then what am I doing? You know, I'm making all this money just to work on vacation and not be with my kids and wife. You know, I think that's just a real struggle that a lot of us have of this balance between work and life. You know, I think another really powerful experience for me personally was before I taught math, I worked in tech, and this was, you know, early stage games on Facebook. And I was the fifth employee of a startup, and we were going to get an offer. And I was, you know, working 80 hours a week. And we were going to get an offer. I do the quick calculation and it's a lot of money. And I didn't feel excited. I felt anxious and a little bit just, you know, sad because I didn't know what I would actually do with the money because all I did was work. Yeah. And so, but, you know, as I think, you know, to circle back though, you know, I think these habits, these ideas we have start so early on. And I think for me, you know, I still have to tell myself, even though I do this every day and I do this work all the time with clients, I have to tell myself, hey, maybe don't work so much. Take a step back and take the time. Enjoy the time and spend the time doing what you want to be doing rather than just working and saving. And I think that's really important for all of us. And it's hard to do.
I want to go back a little bit and just a little more context, which is we sort of talked around this a little bit. The book really structures as a workbook. Tell us why you do it that way and how that works. If a reader picks it up, what are they going to do to work through it?
I love going to conferences and seeing presentations, but I'll tell you what, every single financial presentation I've ever been to is exactly that. It's a presentation with someone talking at you. And I didn't want to be another person talking at the reader, right? And I think part of what I really see a shift in financial planning is I'm not here to tell you what to do, to tell you you have to do this, this, and that, to tell you what's right for your life. You're the CEO of your life, but I want to be that guide that helps you really make those intentional decisions. So I think there's a shift in, hey, I'm not just an expert that tells you you have to do this, this, and this, and go do them. So yeah, so I'm really excited about a shift in financial planning where rather than, you know, me saying, hey, do this, this, and this, and we're working together to figure out what those things are, to look at them, to run scenarios, and do the planning together. So what I really like about the workbook is I'm asking the reader to engage with it, to do that self-exploration, that kind of work on the self-awareness about getting curious about their relationship with money, and that we're going to look at this together as partners. And so I think, you know, that's also, you know, one of the reasons in the beginning of the book, there's a page that you can rip out and give to a friend or your partner. And I do think it's really helpful to do this together. A lot of the times, you know, when we're doing this work with clients, we're doing it with couples and partners. And, you know, I think really one of the most beautiful things in financial planning is when, you know, let's say, you know, one partner looks at the other and says, oh my God, honey, I had no idea you felt that way, or I had no idea that happened to you. And that makes total sense of why you would have done this or why this happened. And, you know, starting that communication and having it be a safe place to talk about these feelings around money.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think the point of the workbook really is to kind of have it be a little bit more fun, have it be more engaging, but also have it be a personal experience. You know, the idea of it being safe is really important to me. And I think that's where Carissa's art is such a great fit, is that it feels safe. It doesn't feel like a you know, money and banking textbook. You know, I really wanted people to feel like it was something approachable and fun and playful, you know, as opposed to going to get a root canal.
Which it can sometimes feel like. All right, we're going to jump right back to that number at the beginning. 54% of Americans feel stress about money multiple times per week. Staggering number. What do you think the financial industry, financial education, and our culture gets mostly wrong about how to address that stress?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. You know, I think that a lot of times we're looking at what's the solution? What's the solution to getting rid of this stress? And I think we're skipping a big part. And going back into kind of cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, I think one of the things we're skipping is just sitting with that feeling, right? And rather than saying, hey, I need to fix this right now, what if I just sit with this anxiety and get curious about what it feels like? Right. And get curious about those feelings rather than just jump into my kind of old habit to avoid that anxiety, where I go do something to avoid it. And, you know, I think just sitting with it, just being curious about how it feels, being curious about what it would really look like in the worst case scenario, rather than having our brain create that for us and get into loops about that, and really being curious about those feelings. And I think that alone helps dissipate the anxiety, at least for me. And so really, I think we're looking for all these solutions. You know, I think this is weird. I just thought of this right now. So, but I think, yeah, I went to the dentist, and they, you know, noticed that I was grinding my teeth, and they prescribed me like an $800 mouth guard that I never wear. I can't wear it because it's awfully uncomfortable and I can't sleep with it. So, but I was thinking about that. I don't think the solution is a mouth guard. I think the solution is figuring out what my underlying anxiety is that I'm grinding my teeth at night, right? And so I think that's where we kind of can lose focus and answer the wrong question in financial planning, is we immediately go to that mouth guard as opposed to really sitting with those feelings and exploring what's creating, what's underneath those numbers and underneath the spreadsheets.
Yeah. So you just mentioned sit with that anxiety, but what if you have someone who just can't seem to sit with that anxiety. It's like they don't, you know, besides the avoidance, they say, well, I don't know. Am I really anxious about that? How do you guide them to say, take a moment, look at that anxiety, come to grips with it, and then is the workbook sitting in front of them? Sit for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes till you could put pen on paper and start working the workbook.
That's great. I'm really glad you brought that up because I think, you know, some of these questions too, I think, and this is really important, are designed, and I mentioned that I'm not a great journaler. So some of these questions are designed to not necessarily force the reader to write the answers right then and there. And I try to be really upfront about that in the beginning of the journal and say, hey, if you can't answer a question, skip it. No worries, come back to it. But I think that's really important that we have so much pressure around someone asks us a question and we got to answer it. We got to figure it out right then. And I think a lot of times this is just designed as far as getting those wheels turning. And my hope is that even if you don't answer the question in the journal, you're walking through the grocery store or you're doing an errand and it pops into your mind and like, oh gosh, that's it, right? That's the answer. So one, I think just knowing that, you know, part of it is just to get you thinking and feeling too, and not necessarily that you have to submit an essay or submit, you know, even two sentences, but really that you're starting to think about it and starting to just be more aware of that anxiety, you know? And I think in terms of kind of removing it in some ways as a block so that the numbers don't feel so scary, you know? And so if we can just kind of reduce it to the point where we can be more intentional and more kind of objective about what the, you know, the overall data looks like.
Okay, so someone finishes Money is Weird. You know, they've genuinely done the work. They've explored their patterns, understood where they came from, and started making more intentional choices. Maybe they even stopped grinding their teeth. What does their financial life look and feel like differently on the other side?
You know, I want to be totally honest here that there is a good chance that their financial life could look exactly the same. But my hope is that they feel better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And that they feel safer and that they have a better relationship to money. And so, you know, I think really what this workbook is about is creating that understanding, that awareness. Not judging yourself, but just looking at it and say, huh, isn't that interesting? It's not going to fix your cash flow. It's not going to, you know, make your investment accounts all jump, but it's, my goal is that you feel safer talking about money, dealing with money, relating to money. And that overall improves your life, improves your relationships, and gives you the time to do, you know, what really is meaningful to you.
Finishing up, what's the one thing you wish every person who will ever pick up this book could hear in a single sentence about the relationship with money?
I want people to feel safe. I didn't expect to say that, but I think that's at the core what what my goal is that so we feel safe, and that to go back to what, you know, you and I both mentioned being so important, that we sleep well at night. And, you know, and I think when we're working with clients, we're looking at, yes, how do we grow your money? But how do we, at the end of the day, grow your money and help you sleep so that you're not losing sleep over your money?
Yeah. Yeah. You're helping their financial life and, or their financial health and their mental health in a way, as far as the relationship to money. Hey, so we just spent a few minutes with Lev Mandel, discussing his wonderful new workbook, Money is Weird. It's a fascinating journey into yourself and your relationship to money. Lev, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Oh, Kevin, such a pleasure. Roger, I really enjoyed, I mean, you guys, just such a blast and fantastic questions. I really appreciate it.
Please subscribe to the Mountain Money Podcast to stay on top of all the latest episodes of KPCW's Mountain Money.
If you have any ideas for Mountain Money, please shoot us an email at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.